to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 24th of August 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Yes, it's the beginning of the week, and another episode of Real Britannia with myself and my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, hello sir, how are you doing today?
I'm very well indeed, thank you very much. Continuing to be an interesting time that we're living through. I find that this particular period, 2020, people will look back on with 2020 hindsight, as the sort of famous pun now goes. People will look back on this particular year as a year when politics became completely surreal, It's an unprecedented thing, and a lot of people use the term unprecedented about the fact that there's this coronavirus. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think the coronavirus is anything like as unique as they're making out. But what is unprecedented is the way in which the government have reacted in such a severe way and such an extreme way to the arrival of the virus, and have been spending money like it's water since the arrival of the virus. And the really surreal thing about it is the fact that very few people have been criticising what the government have been doing. I wrote on Western Spring probably about 3 or 4 months ago, pointing out the fact that the level of spending that the government have launched into will actually cause the national debt to become the largest it's ever been, will cause national debt to become larger than the gross national product of our country, and it's taken the rest of the mainstream media months now to catch up. So now they're all just suddenly realizing, and we're having items on the news, etc., about, you know, how there's this massive amount of public spending and how it's going to have a catastrophic effect on unemployment and things of this sort. And so it's quite strange that nobody else early on in the pandemic actually realised the impact that all this government spending would have. And yet still, here we are now in September, and there hasn't been a scathing attack launched against Rishi Sunak by the Labour Party. And I would have thought that this, could very easily be portrayed as being an irresponsible level of public spending, just shouldn't be accepted without criticism by the opposition. I mean, if we look back at the person who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer prior to Rishi Sunak, it was Sajid Javid. You know, he stepped down early on this year. It's not really quite sure why he stepped down, I don't think, but Sajid Javid had the good fortune to deliver the autumn budget last year, which was just before the general election, and in putting forward that autumn budget, he proposed that there would be an end to austerity, and it was proclaimed there was going to be an end to austerity because of the vast amount of money that Sajid Javid was going to suddenly start spending in developing the country and in introducing a decade of development and progress. Yet the total amount of spending proposed by Sajid Javid was £13.8 billion. And this was attacked by the shadow chancellor at the time as being irresponsible spending, and there was demands that the Office of Budget Responsibility should analyse the budget so that that Sajid Javid couldn't get away with proposing such an irresponsible budget. And it was described, his budget was described as a gimmick budget. It was described as an electioneering stunt, as if it was like one of these giveaway budgets where Sajid Javid was behaving like Lord Bountiful, just giving money away in order to buy the votes. And yet here we are in September 2020, and still there hasn't been a concerted and savage attack by the Labour Party against Rishi Sunak for spending massively more money than Sajid Javid even dreamt of spending, and that's why this year is such a surreal year.
Well, I think that plays in with the fact that neither of them will ever criticise diversity either. They seem to have had this agreement that with this coronavirus that they were going to back each other on whatever was done with it. And it just seems the same to me as they are united in their promotion of diversity and multiculturalism, and they are united in wanting to do what they are doing to the country at the moment. I mean, it's really shocking that people still aren't back at work. We've still got large sectors of the employment that are just doing nothing, and that they're still furloughed. I think it's at the end of this month that businesses are being expected to pay some of the wages of their workers, and I think the businesses would have just folded. If you look at the high streets, you look at the town centres, there's nothing that's going on there. The shops are all closed. If you look at London, I mean, in the middle of the rush hour, London is empty. I've seen some really frightening pictures of London when you think that's supposed to be the centre of all the business. It's City of London there, the centre of the banking world. It should be filled with hustle and bustle. And, you know, there's tumbleweed rolling along the streets there. It's quite shocking to me. And the amount of money they must just be printing, you know, tons and tons of it in order to try and keep things afloat, trying to keep people going. On the other side of it, I've also heard that 60% of people that were furloughed continued working, which, you know, that could be a good thing because it means that there'll be more money about in order to try and pick the economy up once it starts going again. But I think that's what this points to, Max, is that there's an agreement between them. And there's really not that much difference between Labour and Conservative Party, and they have agreed that they're going to push this. They agreed that Rishi Sunak was going to pay out all this money, and again the Labour Party are traditionally, they're the ones that spend, and the Conservative Party are traditionally the ones that don't spend. So maybe that's one of the reasons why they don't want to criticise him, is because they don't want to be seen as criticising the government for spending out this money. They don't want to be seen to be encouraging austerity. So there are two reasons there that I think could be put forward. This. What do you make of those? Both of those reasons, Max?
Well, I think as far as the Labour Party is concerned, they've tended to be portrayed as the tax and spend party by the Conservatives. The point really that I was making initially is that as far as the Labour Party are concerned, the budget that was presented by Sajid Javid last year, last autumn before the general election, was regarded as the kind of budget that the Conservative Party have always criticised the Labour Party for. And so as far as the Labour Party are concerned, in their wildest dreams, they would never in any previous year have thought of spending the kind of money that has been spent by Rishi Sunak this year. You know, it's almost an order of magnitude greater than anybody else has ever dreamt of increasing public spending by. And as I say, there hasn't been any sort of attack on the government for spending all this money. And it's only now that the chickens are coming home to roost and people are starting to think, well, actually, somebody's going to have to pay this money back. And it's being proposed. It's sort of fairly apparent from the conversations that are being had on the mainstream media that the money that is being used to fund all this increasing public spending is money that's being borrowed. It's being borrowed from international investors instead of the government simply just printing the money. The government should just print the money, and then that way, if you borrow money, then you increase the volume of money in the economy, which can be inflationary. If you print money, it increases the volume of money in the economy, which can be inflationary. The only difference is that with one, where you borrow the money, you have both inflation and then you have to pay back a massive debt. Whereas if you just print the money, you have inflation, but you haven't got to pay back a massive debt. And so the country is in a better position. And obviously, in future years, the additional money that has been printed in order to get us through this period, on the assumption that we ever actually really needed to print the money to get us through this period, that money can just be taken out of circulation by the government through taxation, and and the kind of recession that is being is now being hailed as arriving it could have been avoided altogether. In fact, I think it's become more and more apparent, really, that the lockdown and the government's reaction to the virus has been completely and massively over the top, and has just caused unnecessary misery to lots of people. Firstly, because a lot of people, if you stop an economy, it's like stopping a tree from growing. The tree won't just pause from growing; it starts dying the moment you stop it from growing. And the same goes with the economy. The moment you stop it from operating, you're actually causing it to die, because people make other arrangements to get their goods and services from different places. And so now we're in a situation where so much of the commerce, so much of the individual spending and public spending by members of the public is now being done online, to such an extent that high street businesses are having to lay off staff and are in danger of closing, and we've had the sort of bizarre situation this in the last sort of couple of months or so, where pubs and restaurants have just been allowed to open and to start trading, and then in certain parts of the country they've been forced to close again, and we've got this ludicrous situation where the government are designating certain countries as countries that you have to go into quarantine if you visited, and so it's causing people to have to, people that have probably saved for the whole year in order to raise the money so they can have an expensive foreign holiday, you're having to cut short these foreign holidays and scrabble around to try and get a flight or a ship home in order to avoid having to be quarantined, and it's just wrecking all these holidays that people have had, and yet what evidence is there that this is actually doing any good? Because another thing that has suddenly started to be admitted in the press is that Sweden didn't have a lockdown and nothing horrible has happened to Sweden. Sweden's experience of the coronavirus is no more severe than Britain's experience of the coronavirus. In fact, per million of the population, their number of cases and their deaths is lower than ours. And yet Sweden have continued, and their economy has continued to function, because they haven't locked down and they haven't furloughed people and they haven't put businesses out of business, and they've allowed people to have holidays, and so here we are coming towards the end now of 2020, and it would appear that we've got a massive financial headache as a result of the lockdown, and yet it probably was all completely unnecessary. We could have just, I've been saying all along, we could have just made provisions so that people who were in the vulnerable groups could have been shielded from the disease, whilst the vast majority of the population continued to work in the normal way, and that way we would have ended this year in pretty much the same position as Sweden, and we wouldn't have a massive increase in our national debt, and we wouldn't be facing a recession, a massive recession in the way that we are now.
Bit of a glaring anomaly, isn't it, Sweden, that didn't go along with any of this. I'm amazed that Boris Johnson is still wandering around with a mask on. I mean, he's had the disease, he's had the virus, he can't catch it and he can't spread it to anyone else. So why is he still walking around with a mask? I'm so glad.
I think he's setting a good example.
Yeah, that's all I can come to, is that he's just trying to say, look, I'm just the same as everyone else. I'm wearing a mask as well. But thankfully, they said in Wales you don't have to wear these masks. I mean, it's not if it's not an FFP3 mask, it's not going to do anything at all. It's the virus itself is microns small. It's tiny. It will get through a t-shirt. It will get through cloth. It will get through everything but an FFP3 mask. So if you're not wearing one of those proper medical masks, then it's not going to do anything. And with these quarantines, I mean, I do think people were daft going on holiday anyway. I mean, they knew that there was going to be a risk that it would be shut down. They've done that twice now. I do feel sorry for the people that have had to rush back, or when they get back, they know that they've got to stay in at home. But really, I think they should have gone on holiday in Britain, which is something Boris has done, and he's getting a lot of stick for that. And to be honest, I think good on him. He's gone camping, although he's really sort of done the towny thing, and he's put a tent up in the garden of the holiday home that he was staying in Scotland. But at least he stayed out under canvas. There's pictures of him, and people have been joking and saying he looks like a pikey. Look at the state of him. But, you know, that's what you look like if you're walking around in a field in the middle of Scotland. I think good on him for staying in Britain, and good on him for camping. Camping is a good thing, and it's something, I mean, I don't know whether the rest, how much they enjoy it in the rest of Europe, but I've always seen it as a very British thing to go camping, and you can go wild camping. And, you know, the British countryside is some of the most beautiful countryside in the world. I think Britain is the most beautiful country in the world, and you're really going to see it when you go camping, when you get out there in the greenery and among the hills. So I'm pleased that he's actually done that. But everything else that he's done just seems to be the worst possible course of action. And I think we see that with the governments all the time, don't we? And we say, well, is it planned, or is it incompetence? And I think there's a bit of both. And I think with this, there's been a lot of incompetence. There's been a lot of hysteria. There's been a lot of false statistics that were put into the plans in the first place, which led us to having this lockdown, these predictions that there was going to be millions of dead and the hospitals were going to be overwhelmed. And once they knew that that wasn't the case, and really we just needed to look out for the elderly people, they should have changed course. But they didn't, because because the wheels of government, you know, they're so huge and the machinery is so huge, you can't stop it. Once it's started, it's very difficult to stop, because you've got so many components that are actually involved in this. Like people were saying, well, hang on a minute, you're double counting people, or hang on a minute, you're saying that anybody that dies after having a test that was positive, even if it's 3 months later and they die, you're saying that's a COVID death. That means the statistics are wrong. They must have known that within the first month of actually doing these statistics, as soon as they started doing these death statistics. But it's only now, 6 months later, that something is actually being done about it. And I guess it's because it takes that long to actually put a stop to the machinery once it's actually put in gear, if you see what I mean.
No, I think it's because the government don't want to admit that what they did was wrong.
You know, I think that plays into it as well.
They panicked. They were going to follow the Swedish model, and there were all there was discussion about trying to engineer herd immunity. And then there was a bit of a some people in the media threw their hands up and said, "Oh, this, you know, herd immunity idea is nonsense." And the government then immediately panicked and said, "Okay, then we're going to have a lockdown." And so they went into lockdown. Once they'd gone into lockdown, that then began an inevitable train of events that has led us to this situation now, where the government have had to borrow massive amounts of money, where all these people have been furloughed, etc. And the point is, the only way the government can stop it is to say, "No, actually, we were wrong." When they say that they're wrong, that they weren't just wrong. And the consequence of the government being wrong isn't that there's just been a little bit of extra government spending above and beyond what they normally would be. And it isn't a situation in which there are just a few people that have lost their jobs. What's happened is that as a result of the government being wrong on this, and being wrong so to such a great extent, we're in a situation where there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of people whose livelihoods will have been destroyed as a result of lockdown, and the fact that it's now caused an irreversible shift towards working from home and buying your produce on the internet. And as far as government spending is concerned, it's not just caused a little bit of extra government spending, it's caused a massive increase, the largest increase in government spending, I think, in the history of our nation. And when the consequences of you being wrong are so great, you can't actually just turn around and say, well, if you're a government that hopes to be re-elected, you can't just turn around and say, well, actually, we were wrong. We got it wrong, and we got it monumentally wrong. And that's the situation that we're in. The government are trying to save face by pretending that there was good cause for them to have overreacted and for them to have taken the severe action that they did earlier on in the year. And thankfully, the precautions they took weren't actually needed, and the Nightingale hospitals have stood empty ever since they were built, etc. But they had to take the precautions that they did. And it was all necessary, and they can't be blamed for the massive increase in public spending and for the massive increase in unemployment that we're heading into.
I think you're right there, Max. I think that probably plays into it a lot more than how difficult it would be to slow everything down. I mean, what a monumental chaos, monumental just idiocy, basically. But I mean, how can they just keep going on at it? This is the thing. I mean, they still haven't lifted the lockdown, and eventually they're going to have to. Eventually there will be an inquiry into this, and it isn't just the Conservative Party, it's the Labour Party as well. I mean, I think this could end up taking down Labour and Conservative, and if another party makes itself available, then people, it might finally break the stranglehold of Labour and Conservative because of what they have done, and the Labour Party have just stood by and gone along with it. It is phenomenal, really, when you think about it, the overreaction that there has been, and the fact that they are still overreacting now. We've got the results of Sweden. We know that the people that are actually going to die from this are the people that are over 80. We know that it should have been the care homes that were protected. I mean, we can look at Belarus. They didn't have a shutdown either. We can look at Brazil. Mm. Brazil didn't have a shutdown, and Brazil has actually got it one of the worst in the country, but in the world rather. But it's still not that bad. You know, they're second only to the United States for the number of people that have got it or what have you. But what we're also seeing now is the number of deaths has gone right down. I think in Wales they didn't even have any deaths, or they didn't have any new people that had it recently. And contrast that with what's going on in England, and they're saying 12-year-olds have now got to wear masks, and we must now bring in fines of £10,000 for anyone that has a party with over 30 people. And you contrast that with in Wales, well, nobody's got it. nobody got it yesterday, or it was either nobody were found to have it by testing, or nobody actually died of it yesterday. So it's going right down, and yet they're still continuing on with this course, you know, heading.
And I think there is some evidence that as the virus has spread, it's obviously mutates because that's the nature of viruses. They just mutate at an incredibly fast rate. And if you have a virus which initially appears to be fairly virulent in terms of the effect that it has on people, as it mutates, it actually becomes less virulent, because if you've got a virulent virus to begin with, the number of mutations that will make it more virulent will be far fewer than the number of mutations that will make it less virulent. And so what we're having is a situation now where the number of cases of infections is going up, but the number of people dying is going down. And this, again, is something which, you know, anybody who is an epidemiologist would have known that these sort of things, tendencies occur, and so therefore wouldn't have expected the virus to have remained as virulent as it perhaps initially was throughout the whole of the year.
I think there is incompetence in there as well. I mean, because when you look at them targeting the lockdowns, things like that, they've had like a factory will get it in the north, and instead of just making the people at that factory go into quarantine, they've made the whole area go into quarantine. Croatia, apparently there's one small part of Croatia that has got a problem with it, and they've said everybody that comes back from Croatia has got to go into quarantine. They've done the same with Spain, the Balearic Islands in Spain. They don't have a problem there, but they've said everybody from Spain, including the Balearics, has got to go onto this quarantine. So incompetence is playing into it as well. Incompetence, wanting to save face. I mean, this is an almighty amount of egg on the face for them, basically. But eventually they're going to have to admit it. So I should imagine they're scrambling around trying to find some kind of some kind of excuse, somebody that they can blame. I mean, really, they should blame the guy that gave them these statistics in the first place, the one that was caught having it away with his missus when he, with his mistress rather, when he was supposed to be under the lockdown. Professor Whitty, that might be his name. Or that might be...
No. That wasn't Professor, but that was somebody else. But I think this is going to continue until public opinion moves and the public start to defy the government and people just decide, look, this is ridiculous. I'm going to stop wearing a mask. I'm going to carry on living my life as normal. My daughter has planned this wedding for the last 5 years. I'm not going to turn around and tell all the wedding guests they can't come to the wedding, for us to have like a paltry wedding celebration. It's going to take for people to just suddenly realise that they've been lied to throughout pretty much the whole year, that the effect of the virus has been exaggerated vastly for the whole year, and that we're just not going to have it anymore. And I think the signs of this are starting to come. You know, strangely, it is a lot of people in the immigrant community have not trusted the government for various reasons that we're all pretty much aware of. But the it's been in areas where there has been a larger immigrant community that people have tended to defy the government the most. And what we're seeing is that the government aren't really doing anything very much about that. And so we've had the Curry Mile in Manchester. Now it's becoming quite commonplace that the Curry Mile in Manchester becomes absolutely stacked with people. They're sort of rammed in and they just defy social distancing rules. And the police have, done their best to try and make people disperse, etc. But when those kind of things start to happen on a more widespread scale, which they inevitably will do, then everybody's going to realise that the, in this case, the emperor doesn't have any clothes on, and the government are going to have to admit that they got it wrong, and monumentally so.
I think we have to point out we're not encouraging people to break the law here. We're just pointing out that that is a likelihood of what will happen, and that is probably going to be what will eventually get the government to change course. There is, I think, there's a huge protest. Next week, Trafalgar Square, David Icke is the main speaker. I think I saw something about that on Twitter. If that's the case, maybe a lot of people will go to that. They can't say that they can't have these protests. They said that these Black Lives Matter protests were all okay and people weren't spreading the virus doing that. And a comment on what you were pointing out there, Max, about how the Curry Mile was full of people. For Afghanistan Independence Day, it was absolutely packed and the police were attacked. For Pakistan Independence Day, again, it was absolutely packed and the police were attacked. No arrests.
And incidentally, when the police were attacked, the crowds were all chanting, Pakistan, Pakistan, Pakistan. So, I would think that, what was his name? Norman Tebbit with his cricket test was probably proven right there, wasn't he?
Instead of arresting any, we went to a child's birthday party and proudly tweeted about the fact that they arrested three grown-ups and it was a three-year-old's birthday party or something, and they turfed all the grown-ups out. You imagine that, a three-year-old is having their little birthday party and the police turn up and arrest the parents for having a party. I mean, it's certainly not doing anything for the relations between the police and the public. Trying to get them to go along with this. I don't think the police are very happy about it. I think they've said they don't want to be enforcing people to be wearing masks. But as I say, the good thing about wearing masks, we don't have to wear them in Wales. You do in England, Max.
Right.
Shall we move on to talking about our greatest Britons? Or do you want to add anything else that comes to mind about COVID you want to bring up? Or shall we just move into greatest Britons?
I think we've talked that through pretty much today.
Okay, let's get into Geoffrey of Monmouth. We'll have a recap of what we went over last week. We explained that he was born 1095 to 1155. He was a British cleric. He was the author who collected together the history of the kings of Britain, which he said came from a translation from an ancient book in the British language that was given to him by his friend Walter, the Archdeacon of Oxford. Geoffrey himself may well have been of Bretonic origin. He was the first to really make the Arthur mythos popular. And we talked a little bit about Merlin's prophecies, which were the first books that he actually produced. And we also talked about how much of what was in the history of the kings of Britain is confirmed by the historians Bede, Nennius, and Gildas, who were all writing these histories beforehand. But there is now criticism of the history of the kings of Britain. From the time that he wrote it, from about the 12th century, right there up to the 16th century, it was taken as this was the history of Britain. And because of that, it also made its way into lots of other histories. Previously to that, parts of it were publicly known, because Nennius and Gildas had also both written about things that were covered in the history of the kings of Britain. But since then, since the 16th century, there have been criticisms. And as I'm getting a lot of these notes from Wikipedia and adding to them myself, this is what Wikipedia have to say about it. They say, the history of the kings of Britain is now usually considered a literary work of national myth, containing little reliable history. This has since led many modern scholars to agree with William of Newburgh, who wrote around 1190, that it is quite clear that everything this man wrote about Arthur and his successors, or indeed about his predecessors from Vortigern onwards, was made up, partly by himself and partly by others. And I do wonder if he wasn't saying that because it credits the Welsh with being the rightful rulers of the country, and it doesn't paint the Saxons in a very good light. So I do wonder if William of Newburgh didn't have an axe to grind about that. Other contemporaries were similarly unconvinced by Geoffrey's history. For example, Giraldus Cambrensis recounts the experience of a man possessed by demons. He says, if the evil spirits oppressed him too much, the Gospel of St. John was placed on his bosom, when like birds they immediately vanished. But when the book was removed, and the History of the Britons by Geoffrey Arthur was substituted in its place, they instantly reappeared in greater numbers and remained a longer time than usual on his body and on the book. So that shows you that Giraldus Cambrensis was not very happy about the book. And I'm at a loss really to explain why he wouldn't have liked it, because he was Welsh. I find that very confusing. And also because there is a lot of evidence to show that that it was correct, and the Welsh had these lists of these kings. As we said, Geoffrey actually took his work from a work that was already extant, that was written in an earlier British language in the original Welsh, because we've got different types of Welsh. We've got modern Welsh now. There was Middle Welsh, and there was Old Welsh, which is what he claimed he actually had this book in, which ties in with him being Bretonic and coming from Brittany, and the histories going to Brittany as well. So I'm really at a loss to explain why they were criticizing it. I think modern people like to criticize it because they like to try and make out that we were just cavemen, and until the Romans came, we really didn't amount to much in Britain, whereas the history of the kings of Britain tells a different story. Max, I know you're a little bit critical of some of the history in this. What are your views on what Wikipedia has to say here on your own?
I sound critical. I'm just a little bit concerned, really, that whilst the history written by Geoffrey of Monmouth exists, and whilst that does tie in with some other histories that were written at the time, generally speaking, from a scientific perspective, historians like there to be some kind of written record of the history, and they like there to be physical evidence as well. And I think that the thing that's missing with most of this is that there is very little in the way of physical evidence, but there are the books, and the books do appear to be written by more than one person. And I have to say that the logic of Giraldus Cambrensis in criticising Geoffrey of Monmouth was a logic appears to be entirely absent in that particular argument that he puts forward about evil spirits. So it would appear that the people who were criticising Geoffrey of Monmouth, if Giraldus Cambrensis is typical of them, were far more motivated by myth and hocus pocus than Geoffrey of Monmouth could possibly have been.
There have actually been a lot of coins that have been found since which actually make mention of some of the kings that are in the history of the kings of Britain. And these are pre-Roman coins. Cassivellaunus is one of them. I was looking at some of them last night in L.A. Waddell's book, The Phoenician Origin of Britons, Scots and Anglo-Saxons, and it has lots of drawings of these coins that were found, and quite a few of them actually mention these kings from before the Romans came, which show that we had a monetary system here. We had coinage that we were using. We had gold coins, and we also had iron bars. So that's one of the proofs that these kings did exist. Obviously, there's a lot of romanticizing in Geoffrey's work because it has dialogue in it. And then, you know, you're not going to have dialogue recorded. And he goes into quite some detail. But I think the essentials probably have the ring of truth to them, to me, because he's saying he got these essentials from this other work. If it had been wildly different to what people thought their history was, it would have been said, and that would have been pointed out as an argument rather than these demons flocked to the body when it had the book there. You know, they would have used a more logical argument than that when they were attacking it. But as we'll see, there is other evidence to support it. There was a lot of support for it everywhere else, in actual fact. Geoffrey's major work was nevertheless widely disseminated throughout medieval Western Europe. Acton Gristam listed 186 extant manuscripts in 1929, and others have been identified since. It enjoyed a significant afterlife in a variety of forms, including translations and adaptations such as Wace's Anglo-Norman Roman de Brute, Layerman's Middle English Brute, and several anonymous Middle Welsh versions known as Brut y Brenieth, the Brute of the Kings, where it was generally accepted as a true account. And they also say that it was actually copied from the Brut to Cilion, which is a book that was lost, which was a Welsh history that was around before he actually wrote the history of the kings of Britain. In 2017, Miles Russell published the initial results of the Lost Voices of Celtic Britain project established at Bournemouth University, and the main conclusion of the study was that the history of the kings of Britain appears to contain significant demonstrable archaeological fact, despite being compiled many centuries after the period that it describes. Geoffrey seems to have brought together a disparate source of source material, including folklore, chronicles, king lists, dynastic tables, oral tales, and bardic praise poems, some of which would have been irrevocably garbled or corrupted. In doing so, Geoffrey exercised considerable editorial control, massaging the information and smoothing out apparent inconsistencies in order to create a single grand narrative. Much of the information that he used can be shown to be derived from two discrete sources. Number one, the orally transmitted heroic tales of the Cativellani and the Trinovantes, two essentially pro-Roman tribes inhabiting central southeastern Britain at the very end of the Iron Age. And number two, the king lists of important post-Roman dynasties that ruled territories in Western Britain. And we've talked about the Cativellani and we've talked about the Trinovantes before, when we were talking about Boadicea. And stretching this source material out, chopping, changing and re-editing it in the process, Geoffrey added additional information culled from later Roman histories and also those of the Dark Ages and earlier medieval writers such as Gildas and Bede. So the most up-to-date information on this, I guess, is that the basics of it are true. It says significant demonstrable archaeological fact. And I would guess that a lot of that comes from the coins that have been found. And it says here that a lot of it was orally transmitted because we had this bardic tradition. We had the bards who would recite poems that were telling us about our history and the heroes of our past. And that was still going on at the time. So that's where some of it would have come from. The written stuff would be from the king lists from probably about 30 AD onwards that were possibly written down in Latin that survived. And before that, I guess you've got the time before that to Brutus, which would have come down through being orally transmitted. But we did also have Ogham at the time, which is the Irish, the Druidic way of communicating. It's a line. They would put a line, and then they would have perpendicular lines that went across it, and they would do it on the corner of a stone, and they would put these lines on it. And we do have some stones that have inscriptions in Latin, and then they have inscriptions of Ogham along the side of it. So there was writing like that, but not much of that has survived, just this stuff that's actually on the stones. So I think what he's saying is basically it's true, but there's a romanticizing as well, and also where he's trying to tie it all in together to make it into a cohesive story, which was really his genius, I think, was putting it all together to create a single story. Because don't forget, you also would have had different tribes in this, and the tribes themselves would have been warring against one another before it came to warring with the Romans or warring with the Saxons. What do you make of the modern description of this, Max?
Well, there does seem to be more to it than just a single book written by a single man. I can see, and as we sort of agreed last week, that to have a single creation myth for a nation is not a bad thing, because what tends to bind people is a common belief in a common history. And so as far as the various tribes of the Britons that inhabited large swathes of this country during that period, to have this common myth where the individual mythic elements remembered by the individual tribes were tied into one story, I can see that would be a very powerful thing. And that probably was the most significant aspect of Geoffrey of Monmouth's work here in creating something that that anybody who was an ancient Briton could really believe in and could take inspiration from.
Yeah, I think he was just as important as people like Alfred the Great who were trying to get the country together. It was Geoffrey of Monmouth who put the histories together into this one myth, this uniting myth that the British, the Britons, the Saxons, and the Normans could have and could get together around and say, well, these were our heroes from our past, and we were all interconnected with these people. He was a very important part in the coming together of the United Kingdom, I would say, and the Welsh getting on with the English and getting on with the Saxons.
And I think it's a great pity that the Bronze Age and the Iron Age in Britain is fairly well dismissed as being a period warranting greater research and investigation into, as far as the education system in this country is concerned. I think as far as school children are concerned, usually those are periods that tend to be pretty much glossed over. And as you say, the people of Britain in those times are generally regarded as being backward and less advanced than the Romans were. So it's a great shame that a lot of the names that we've been talking about in earlier episodes of this Greatest Britain series, plus also a lot of the names that we're talking about here derived from the writings of Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's a great pity that we're not more familiar with these people and not more familiar with the stories that are told about the people. And it's my sort of initial reaction, because this is an area that I don't have a great deal of knowledge on, I have to admit. We're going on to talk about individual proposed by Geoffrey of Monmouth as the first king of the Britons, whose name is Brutus. And I would think if you stopped 1,000 people in the street in Britain today and asked them who Brutus was, they would probably say it was the big, muscly, fat guy that used to fight with Popeye. And that's the level of knowledge that the vast majority of people in this country would have of this period in our history, sadly.
And I think also because there is mythic aspects that are woven into this, that like there was one king called Bladad who supposedly tried to fly, so which ties in with the Greek myth of Icarus. So there are mythic aspects to this. Brutus has a vision of Diana when he's at the temple. So because there are aspects like that to it, and also with Merlin as well, and Merlin's prophecies, I think people today look at it and they would tend to just write it off because it contains these supernatural parts to it. But if you look at works like Gerald S. Cambrensis and his works, where he's travelling around Wales, it's full of supernatural things. I mean, the people back then, they believed in the supernatural. It was as real to them as science is to us today. But that doesn't mean that the people that he's talking about didn't actually exist. When you've got places that are named after them, that tends to say that these people really did exist, because when you look at the names of places, say take Jerusalem, for instance, that's been called Jerusalem for thousands of years. These names, they do persist through time, which is another aspect that we'll probably get into in this. Well, as you said there, Max, the first king in the list is Brutus. And you know, we can't do Greatest Britons without doing the first king and who the country is actually named after. And we'll look at the evidence for him, and we'll also give a brief overview of the story of Brutus. I think we'll start with the overview of what we know about Brutus, and then we'll look at the evidence for him after that. I think that's probably the best way to do it, so that listeners get an idea of the narrative. The history itself begins with the Trojan Aeneas, who, according to Roman legend, settled in Italy after the Trojan War. And he's written about in the Odyssey, in the Iliad. I think it's pretty well accepted that Aeneas was a real person. He's referred to in lots of other places. And Brutus's father is Silvius, the son of Ascanius, the son of Aeneas, who was allowed to leave Troy. A magician who predicts great things for the unborn Brutus also foretells that he will kill both his parents. He does so in a freak hunting accident in the same manner described as in Nennius's Historia Britonum, and is banished. And that's the Nennius's history book that was written centuries before Geoffrey of Monmouth's one that also mentions Brutus. Travelling to Greece, he discovers a group of Trojans enslaved there. He becomes their leader, and after a series of battles, they defeat the Greek king Pandrasius by attacking his camp at night after capturing the guards. He takes Pandrasius hostage and forces him to let his people go. Brutus realises there are not enough room for both peoples in Greece, and after taking Pandrasius' daughter Imogene in marriage, he is given ships and provisions for a voyage to find a new land, and he sets sail. The Trojans land on a deserted island and discover an abandoned temple to Diana. After performing the appropriate ritual, Brutus falls asleep in front of the goddess's statue and is given a vision of the land where he is destined to settle, a white island in the Western Ocean inhabited only by a few giants. And this is the translation from the Latin of what Diana supposedly said to him in his vision. Brutus, there lies beyond the Gallic bounds an island which the western sea surrounds. By giants once possessed, now few remain to bar thy entrance or obstruct thy reign. To reach that happy shore thy sails employ, their fate decrees to raise a second Troy and found an empire in thy royal line, which time shall never destroy nor bounds confine. And that last line there, they thought that was very prescient when they actually had the British Empire. They saw that as the fulfillment of this prophecy. And I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, you're thinking this is 1,000 years ago, a long, long time before the British Empire, and you've got this prophecy that Britain will have an empire. There will be no bounds to actually confine Britain, and there will be an empire in thy royal line. So I think that that's something that bears thinking about. Even if that was just made up by Geoffrey of Monmouth, it's still 1,000 years ago. He had some notion that Britain was going to have a worldwide empire. basically.
Yeah.
After some adventures in North Africa, which shows that that we had white people in North Africa, not African Negroes, and a close encounter with the Sirens, so there we have the mythical point, Brutus discovers another group of exiled Trojans living on the shores of the Tyrrhenian Sea, led by the prodigious warrior Corineus, who becomes his close friend. In Gaul, Corineus provokes a war with Gopherius Pictus, the king of Aquitaine, after hunting in the king's forests without permission. Brutus's nephew Chironus dies in the fighting, and the city of Tours is founded, where he is buried. And they say that the huge tumulus at Tours was actually created by Brutus, and that's where his nephew is buried in this huge tumulus, which the city is also named after. The Trojans win most of their battles, but are conscious that the Gauls have the advantage in number. So they go back to their ships and sail for Britain, which is then called Albion. They land on Totnesium Illitus, the seacoast of Totnes, where they meet the giant descendants of Albion and defeat them. And there is an idea that what they're actually talking about here is the giant descendants. What they mean is the people that created the giant stone circles and the giant dolmens, and the people that he actually conquered were previous parts of his tribe anyway. They were Phoenicians, they were Trojans. The people that were in Britain already were the same ethnicity as him, but they were the builders of the stone circles and the dolmens. Because, as we'll see in this next bit, Corineus has a fight with one of these giants, and he's actually able to pick him up and throw him, which says that he wasn't actually of giant stature. It must have been referring to something else. Well, Brutus renames the island after himself and becomes its first king. Corineus, his friend, becomes the ruler of Cornwall, which is named after him. They are harassed by the giants during a festival, but kill all of them but their leader, the largest giant Gogmagog, or Gomagot, who is saved for a wrestling match against Corineus. Corineus then throws him over a cliff to his death at Plymouth. Brutus then founds a city on the banks of the River Thames, which he calls Troy Nova, or New Troy, and the name is in time corrupted to Trinovantium, and the city is later called London. He creates laws for his people based on the laws of Troy and rules for 24 years. After his death, he is buried in Trinovantium, and the island is divided between his three sons, Locrinus, who has England, Albernactus, who has Scotland, and Camber, who has Wales. And there is legend that that's where the names actually came from, but there is also another legend that he named his sons after the names of those different parts of Britain, basically. So Locrinus for England, Albernactus for Scotland, and Camber for Wales, saying that they already had these names, and that was the tribes that were there. And Brutus is basically made the king of the whole island. And that is the story of Brutus. Do you want to comment on that, Max, at all, the legend of Brutus?
Just to say that you mentioned a bit earlier on about there being white people living in Africa north of the Sahara, and of course the great opponents of the Roman Empire for much of its history were the Carthaginians, and the Carthaginians occupied the area which is now Tunisia primarily, and they were a white nation, and Hannibal, who marched with his elephants against Rome, was Carthaginian and was therefore white. I think, as far as the legend of Brutus is concerned, it when presented in the way that you have here, I think it has a high degree of credibility, particularly. I think that we're perhaps thinking here in some respects that Brutus would have been travelling with just with small numbers of men. But when we consider that where he was, when he went to Greece, he rallied enough people to defeat the king there, or to defeat a king, he must have had thousands of soldiers following him, and so therefore him moving around would have been him transporting a large army, and so therefore in that he must have had a large army first of all to defeat a king of Greece, But then, with a large army landing in the south of England, at a time when their whole of the British Isles would have been covered by smaller tribes, who didn't have large kingdoms at the time, then we can see that he could well have conquered large swathes of Britain in the way that this the story suggests.
He had a fleet of ships. I mean, it was the Trojans that were all in subjection in one of these places that he ended up freeing. He ended up freeing four lots from one place and one lot from when he went into Greece. And where we get this word, the Tyrrhenian Sea, which is around by Italy, that's actually named after Tyre, which is Phoenicia, which is today called Syria. And that shows us that the Phoenicians were all the way up in Italy. And apparently they were in Britain as well. And they would have known his pedigree, that he was a Trojan prince. He was from, his father was Silvius. That's another famous person. And the Romans themselves were also descended from this same family. Romulus, from the legend of Romulus and Remus, was also descended from this same family. So they were all linked in together. They were all the same ethnicity. And at this time, we had castes as well, don't forget. We had a noble caste and we had a working caste. And, you know, you paid your respects to somebody once you knew that they were from this noble caste. And
this is a little different, really, from the situation that existed at the beginning of the 20th century, where we had kings and queens and the nobility of Germany and of Russia and of Britain and several other European countries as well, all being first cousins and all being interrelated.
Yeah, because, you know, blue blood had to marry blue blood. If you were royalty, then you had to marry other royalty. I think Aeneas married the daughter of someone called Latium, and that started up the Latins. And then you've got Romulus, who would have been one of Brutus's cousins. So you can see that you've got the same sort of families that are, according to myth, started off these empires. And that ties us into the Romans. And it shows that we were the same ethnicity as the Romans. So, of course, when the Romans came into Britain, that's why we don't really find any change to our DNA. We don't find any change at all to the genetics. Because it was essentially it was the same people coming into Britain that were already here. The legend of Albion, where that got its name from as well, that was supposedly from a Phoenician king who had, I think it was 40 daughters, something like that. And one of the daughters he married to a prince, and the prince was a really good prince, and she refused to do what the prince told her to do. And the prince came back to the king and said, look, this wife you've given me, she's been very badly behaved. And the king said to his daughter, you must obey your husband. And she said, okay, I'll obey my husband. And she went and said to her 40 sisters, let's all murder our husbands tonight. And they did. They murdered the husband. So they were all put on a ship and they were cast adrift. And the ship, I mean, this is all legend. This is all myth, basically. And the ship itself then landed in England, and the princess's name was Albion. So the name England was actually given this name Albion after this feminist, basically. But there was nobody on the island, so they ended up interbreeding with devils and producing giants, which is supposedly the explanation for who these giants were that Brutus slaughtered. So you can see from that, all of that is supernatural. All of that is myth, but it does contain a little bit of truth in that the original settlers of Britain were from Phoenicia, from this Phoenician king. I think he was called Dungi or something like that. And he is talked about elsewhere. Again, there's more research that I need to do on this. There's a guy called Alan Wilson who is an absolute expert on this, and he wrote a book, I think, called The Trojan Empire, something like that. And I'm hoping that eventually I will be able to get hold of that. He's an alternative historian that I have a lot of respect for. So I don't know that much about the origins of this dungi, but apparently he's done a lot of research into it. And this is where we get the name Surrey from, which comes from Syria. And we've got Bridport, which comes from Brutusport, which is in Dorset. And we'll probably see next week as well, when we get into the proofs of this, that there are quite a lot of places that are actually named after Brutus like Cornwall, named after Corineus. And that's the tale of where Cornwall got its name from. But we'll get into all that next week. Max, do you want to add anything else to that before we finish today?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is a good point for us to pause.
Okay, we'll carry on with this next week then. Thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.